Beg pardon?
Part 3.
This is R. E. Bob Sheldon again, finishing his statements about Alaska's early days. This is R.E. Bob Sheldon continuing his statement about the early days in Alaska with particular reference to what happened to Sophie Smith. When Sophie Smith got to where the guard was at the approach to the dock, everybody that was following on behind, probably 100, maybe 125 yards, they all stopped too, you see. That's as close as they wanted to get to. Two people that's going to start arguing with a gun. So we all stopped right there, and of course, like all news kids, well, I was right in front, and I wanted to see it all too. And because I knew Sophie Smith, I knew Mr. Reed, and I knew what was taking place and what it was all about, but I couldn't foresee what was, for sure, what was going to happen. So finally, when this head-jerking business got to a point where that's as far as they could get the head-jerking, why, Sophie Smith whipped this rifle right down off of his shoulder just like that. He had this Winchester like this. And he whipped it right down like that toward Mr. Reed, who was sitting, as I say, up like this, and who immediately jumped down off of the railing and grabbed the muzzle of that gun with his left hand to jerk it away from him, because it was pointed right at his middle. And in those days, they had these 30-45-90s, or what did they call those lead bullets that was as big as your finger. When they went through anybody, boy, they left their mark. I don't know much about guns, but they were those old heavy-duty Winchesters they brought up here. So he grabbed that muzzle to pull it away from him, and before he got it cleared by, Sophie Smith pulled the trigger, and the bullet and the ball went right through his groin here and through his leg socket, apparently, and put him to his knees. And even on his knees, Frank Reed was, he was a tall man, big man. Even on his knees, he was putting there as big as Sophie Smith. But he held that gun out like this away while Sophie Smith was trying to jerk it back to get it back toward his middle to give him another shot, and in the meantime reached in and got his .38 revolver and fired three shots while this gun was being jerked back and forth here, and he was trying to hold it away from him, and did hold it away by sheer necessity. If he ever allowed it to get back, why, that would be it. And he fired three shots. And the pictures that were taken of Sophie Smith's body, well, Sophie Smith keeled over finally, and one shot grazed right along his arm, which is plainly visible in the pictures that are all over the country that you can get of Sophie Smith. Another ball went right by his side and burnt a red streak there that shows right up in the pictures that were taken of him in the morgue after the autopsy. And the third ball went right through his heart, and over went Sophie Smith, his rifle one way and his hat the other way, and over went Reed, who was very badly hurt. And he was holding himself up by sheer nerve, because he had a terrific hurt there with that lead bullet. And the Sophie Smith broke up the meeting all right, but not just the way he anticipated. Because for where we were standing, looking straight down that dockway, the way those men came out of our warehouse reminded me as a kid when I poked a stick in a hornet's nest and stirred them up. And brother, the way they came out of there was something. And they came up that dock as fast as they could come. And they got a hold of a piece of canvas. They didn't even have a stretcher. They got a hold of a piece of canvas and put Mr. Reed in the canvas. Sophie was laying there, eyes wide open, hat one way, sprawled all out there, the gun laying there, and he was dead, period. But Reed was still alive, and they took him up to the Bishop Rowe Hospital, where Miss Dickey was the head nurse, and the White Pass physician, Dr. Whiting, and the other three doctors in Skagway were right up there working on him to try to save him. And when they carried him by where we were all standing, men, women, and children that had stopped at this deadline, he was moaning and groaning something fierce, and they carried him to the hospital, and where he lived for 2 weeks. And of course he told what conversation took place between he and Soapy, and it was just the conversation you'd naturally expect. Soapy Smith, Reed said, "Where do you think you're going? Or they don't need you down there." Soapy probably said, "Well, I'd like to see you or any other SOB stop me from going down there," and one mud led to another, and finally this gun. Now that's what I saw. And other people's version of what happened to Soapy Smith, to the contrary notwithstanding, that's what happened to Soapy Smith. And his body was allowed to lay there till about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Nobody dared touch it. Nobody dared show enough sympathy for Soapy Smith to even fold his arms over his chest like you do to any corpse and kick their feet together and close their eyelids. Because if they had somebody liable to plug him as a Soapy Smith sympathizer, that's how intense the sentiment was in that town. And finally, the Presbyterian minister and two other people went to the Cy Tanner. You remember Cy Tanner, Mr. You remember old Cy Tanner? Yeah, Cy Tanner. He was one of the ones who was very instrumental in keeping the people from bringing any further disgrace on Skagway by hanging these guys to all the various yardarms around there, telephone poles. And he arranged with the, because everybody got a gun right away and was looking for anybody that looked like a Soapy Smith gang of any kind, including the editor of the paper, Dr. Hornby. And they rounded up all the Soapy Smith gang, probably 15 or 16 of them, and they put them aboard the little steamer Tees. The Canadian little steamer Tees happened to be in port. And they rounded them up and took them down and put them on that boat over the captain's protest, because they didn't have any money or no tickets. But the captain of that Canadian boat was told to take those people out of here and don't put them ashore in any Alaska waters, or don't you ever come back here again. That's how hopped up they were. And the Canadian captain said, "Well, it's not my responsibility. I didn't bring them here." "Well, we don't know that. You're taking them away anyway." So they loaded them on the little steamer Tees, and away they went out of there. But the worst element, the three major ones that became the famous and notorious gang left, was old Daddy Tripp and Slim Jim and a fellow named Bowers. There are two or three citizens in Alaska yet who are claimed to be sympathetic to the Soapy Smith gang. Some of them have been in business for different times in different Alaska towns. Skagway people don't talk about it. My biggest shock was when I went to the Curry Hotel one time on a trip from here to Anchorage. I found one of them, a night clerk in the government's hotel there. The FBI just wasn't as strict in those days as they are now. And another one I found over here in St. Joseph's Hospital, very bad shape, and later died there. And I went in to see him, and he said, "Now, Bobby, don't tell anybody who I am." Well, I said, "Okay." So he didn't last much longer. I forget what his trouble was. So because they were run out of the country and told never to come back. Now, the sentiment against Soapy Smith was so strong that when they took his body up to the cemetery, they wouldn't bury his body in the cemetery and desecrate that hallowed ground. They buried him outside the cemetery, just outside the boundary where his grave still is available for anybody to see. And his marker consisted of a piece of wood, a wooden board, I would say 3 feet high, maybe 3.5 feet high or so, sharpened at the bottom, rounded at the top, about 1¼ inches thick, painted white, and on it said, "Jefferson R. Smith." His full name was Jefferson Randolph Smith. I don't know whether he was related to the Randolphs in Virginia or not, but Jefferson Randolph Smith, age 38, died July the 8th, 1898. And when the tourists started coming to Alaska, the people of Skagway cultivated the business of taking visitors from the boats up to see Soapy Smith's grave. And incidentally, Frank Reed had a very fine locally constructed monument there that was a beautiful piece of work out of Alaska granite. And on the base it said he gave his life for the honor of Skagway. And that monument is still there, and the tourists couldn't do any damage to that without a pickaxe. But this other one, they gradually took their jackknives and started slipping little shavings off of this Soapy Smith board and sticking it in their pocket to take home to show the folks they got a chip off of Soapy Smith's tombstone. Finally, there was nothing left but a little sharp peak up like this. And the name was all gone, and it didn't mean anything. And Mrs. Pullen, who was, as I say, one of Skagway's very prominent civic-minded leaders for years, and developed quite an institution there known as the Pullen House, in which she had gathered much in the way of Alaskana. And when the tourists would come to Skagway on the Canadian boats, particularly, and the American Alaska Steamship Company boats, she would get groups of those tourists in her living room and not let any local Skagway people in. She would only tell her story, like I'm telling my story to you. I don't particularly care who hears my story, but she would tell her story to tourists, but she didn't let the local people in. And the Skagway people used to wonder why. It developed that she, I don't mean any disrespect to Mrs. Pullen, she's still the motherly woman that I thought a lot of and did a lot for me, and I still think a lot of as one of Alaska's outstanding women. But she got to romancing on this episode for the entertainment of tourists. It can go on all over Alaska. I heard over the radio here all the time where they're still becoming very dramatic and romantic about what will attract tourists to run around out here and pan gold and do a lot of other things. Well, she was capitalizing on this situation in Skagway and made a living out of it for years. But some of the stories she told to the tourists were a little on the fantastic side. And when the tourists would come on down the Yukon and come down to Fairbanks, where I would meet them, and casually you'd get to talking to some of them, and they'd tell us about the wonderful visit they had in Skagway, and the fine visit with Mrs. Pullen, how she told, how she held Soapy Smith's head in her lap when he was dying. She had an apron with some chicken blood or something on it. And it made a nice, entertaining story. And she definitely gave the impression toward the last that Soapy Smith, as I say, was a sort of Robin Hood. And of course, poor Mrs. Pullen is now passed to the great beyond. Anything I told this boy in June of the spring, the story, and I said, nothing you can say is but what is too good. It's all for Mrs. Pullen. She's entitled to all the fine things you can say about her, because she earned it, and she had it. She was a wonderful person. And I'm looking for that copy of the Reader's Digest to come out sooner or later, telling about this, carrying this article on Mrs. Pullen. And Frank Reed had a great funeral. Everybody in the town was up there, and church was overflowing. He was highly respected and died at the peak of his career. And as his monument very well says, he gave his life for the honor of Skagway. I think perhaps that covers all of the points that I had in mind when I came out here this evening, and I thank you for your very kind attention. And if any part of my remarks are of any been interesting and entertaining to you. I'm very happy about it.
Thank you, Mr. What is your name?
I'm Chaplain Arthur Eves from Ladd Air Force Base.
And I'm Barbara Eves, his wife from Ladd Air Force Base.
Thank you.
And I would like to rejoin her.
What's your name right there, please?
Florence Manville, Secretary, Treasurer.
Francis Baker, just a visitor.
Your name on the tape, please?
Oh, Ernest E. Curtis.
And this is Ernest E. Curtis.
Thank you. What's your name on the tape,
please? Alexander Jensen.
Thank you. What's your name on the tape?
Oh, I'm Sadie Bell Tetterick.
Mrs. Tetterick from Bellevue, Ohio.
Mrs. Johnson from Vernon, Indiana.
The name on the tape?
W.B. Luella, Juneau, Alaska. Bill Cashman, College.
Thanks,
Bill. Bob Kaufman, Fairbanks.
Thank you.
Elmas Horst Newber, Goshen, Indiana.
Thank you.
Nancy Vines, Middlebury, Indiana.
I'm a little Hoosier too. I was born in Indiana.
You don't mean you're the first one we met?
Lou.
Just give me your name. I want to take your name
off. Earl Pilgrim.
Miss Zoe Reed.
Mrs. Robert E. Sheldon.
Johnny and Ola. Zoe Reed.
That reminded me of it when you said you
were. Paolo. Alberta Blaker. Alma Matlock.
Andy Wicken. What do you want?
Your name?
Oh, Ted Loftus. I've enjoyed the talk tonight very much. Ernest Tetterick. Craig Tetterick, school teacher from Ohio. That's all the people that were present tonight on the tape.
That was taken at the University of Alaska in the Home Economics Room on June the 23rd, 1960, by Harry Hughes for the Pioneers of Igloo 4, Fairbanks, Alaska.